Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia, Solotopia, Solotopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we must. Yeah! Solartopia, all over God's green world, and time for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman speaking to you from the nation's capital, where there is taxation without representation. I am at my niece's home in Washington, D.C., and we are not in a state. This place, Washington, D.C., has no senators and no congresspeople. It's astonishing. More people than Vermont or Wyoming, I believe, and yet no statehood. We want statehood for Washington, D.C. in our Solartopian world. We have a repeat guest with us today, but I am not going to mention the B word, bicycle, or Charlie Komanoff and I will go off on another hour talking about something we truly love, which is the bicycle. Although I will say that coming down on the bus, on the Megabus today from New York City to Washington, I noticed that the city of New York is now wanting to stick the rental bike company there with $1 million bill for parking spaces. I don't get it. Just ridiculous greed as far as I can tell. But Charlie, you want to give us a quick word on that? So
we can no, Harvey, we're not going to go there. We'll never get out.
All right. Otherwise, we'll be on bikes again. It was a wonderful show to talk to you with bikes. I love bicycles so much. And Leonardo's great gift to Leonardo da Vinci's great gift to the world. Most people, if you ask them who invented the bicycle, I think the largest percentage of answers I get are the Wright brothers. The Wright brothers actually had a bicycle business in Dayton. That's what they did. And there is a Wright brothers bicycle in the Smithsonian, but it was Leonardo da Vinci that invented it. So, Charlie, you're not going to mention the word bicycle. We are going to talk today about carbon and carbon taxation and global warming and energy. Charlie Komanoff is one of the world's leading experts on energy in general, renewables, carbon, nuclear in particular. I've been at it for decades and decades. I don't think there's anybody who knows more than you do about this topic. So let's start, Charles Komanoff. Let's start with your website and your organization and how people can get a hold of you, and we'll do it at the end of the hour as well. So tell us, Charlie Komanoff, how to get in touch with you.
Oh, yeah. I've got two websites. My own is komanoff.net, and Komanoff is K-O-M-A-N-O-F-F. That's like French fries.
Like in the pursuit of happiness. Yes, go ahead.
And that's got a wide range of stuff that I do because I've got my fingers in a lot of different pies. And then the other site is the Carbon Tax Center, and that's carbontax.org. And that's more wonky, professorial, quantitative policy oriented. But, you know, some cool stuff there, especially for people who are looking for a way out of the climate crisis. And the Carbon Tax Center is where you should go if you agree with the proposition that the most critical thing we can do is to eliminate the artificial advantage that fossil fuels have over renewables and efficiency, which is that the fossil fuels get to dump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and disrupt the Earth's climate, and not have to pay a penny for that privilege.
Okay, so I'm looking at the Carbon Tax Center website right now. Why taxes on carbon pollution are essential, what's happening now, and how can you help? Let's start with Proposition 1. Tell us, Charles Komanoff, why are carbon taxes essential?
You know, it kind of comes down to the fact that price is a motivating factor in just about every single one of the billions of decisions that get made on a daily basis that collectively determine around the world how much energy gets used and what kinds of energy get used. You know, what are some of those decisions? Mundane things like, you know, should I try to bike to work today or take a car? If I'm in a typical American two-car family, do I take the guzzler or the, you know, or the efficient car? How do I drive? You know, those are kind of day-to-day decisions. Or things like turning off light switches, replacing your light bulbs, using your refrigerator more efficiently, you know, on and on and on. But then there are intermediate decisions, you know, decisions with 5-year, 10-year, 20-year time horizons that have to do with where people choose to live, where they choose to work, where they choose to send their kids to school, because if they opt for a long-distance solution, then they're going to lock themselves in to high carbon. Now, Harvey, I have to just stop and say that what I said a moment ago about people choosing to where they live or work or send their kids to school, that is a very loaded concept. And you and I know, and our listeners know, that Americans have fewer and fewer choices in those regards, that more and more autonomy in, you know, where and how one chooses to live and work is a privilege that is reserved for, you know, the upper 10% or 1% or 0.1%. And so I just want to make clear to our listeners that there is an enormous social justice component going through the whole discussion about carbon. But anyway, to return to the main theme, there are decisions with, you know, 50-year time horizons. Is the electricity provider going to build a coal plant, which will have massive carbon emissions, a natural gas-fired plant, which will have large carbon emissions, or a wind farm, or a solar farm, or even better, you know, is your electricity provider going to face competition from rooftop solar providers so that you can be your own power plant, something that our host, Harvey Wasserman, has been writing about and advocating for a really long time, bless his heart. And
thank you, Charles. I need that.
Or even things like the aircraft that an airline is going to order. There are trade-offs between upfront cost and fuel efficiency. And with a carbon tax, those decisions would tend to get tilted more toward efficiency, even if there's a higher upfront cost. And I guess the subtext in all of this, you know, the other subtext, is that all of these decisions can be influenced at the margin by price, and that so long as the fossil fuel users get to burn fossil fuels and spew carbon emissions without the cost of those emissions to the climate being factored into the price of the fuels and therefore into the decisions they make, the world is going to go on merrily burning more and more carbon. And great policies like efficiency standards, renewable portfolio standards that require states or utilities to buy rising percentages of renewable, you know, solar and wind power, et cetera, are going to be, I don't want to say pissing into the wind, but they're not going to be enough, because the whole momentum of energy production and consumption is going to be toward high fossil fuel use, whereas a carbon price through a carbon tax is going to insinuate and disseminate the cost of climate damage into the prices of fossil fuels and thus into all those decisions. And so it's not the only policy. We need all of these things working together. But those of us who advocate for a carbon tax are pretty fervent about believing that it has to be at the center of climate and energy policy.
Well, of course, we're operating on the presumption, which I, of course, endorse, and 95% of the world's climate scientists endorse, which is that carbon emissions do cause the unbalancing of our weather patterns. We are calling it global warming these days, but to me, it's climate chaos. The best term I've heard actually is global weirding,
yep.
which has been attributed to Hunter Robbins by Amory Robbins, who would know. I always thought Amory Robbins came up with it, but he says Hunter came up with it. So Charles Komanoff, I got to tell you, this morning I was in Teaneck, New Jersey. My daughter and son-in-law have bought a home in Teaneck, and I had to go into Manhattan. And it's like a Mad Magazine cartoon. Buses, trucks, cars, every vehicle on earth seems to be headed into Manhattan in the morning. And my understanding now, with this whole uproar with Chris Christie purposely jamming up the traffic on the George Washington Bridge.
Yeah.
Does my memory serve me well? Didn't Chris Christie kill an $8 billion project that would have run a train over to New Jersey from New York? Is my memory serving me right on that?
Harvey, once again, you managed to use the public scandal, the visible scandal, which was Christie's aides deliberately causing a traffic jam in Fort Lee on the Jersey side of the George Washington Bridge for political retribution, as a window into the real scandal, which is exactly as you said, that in 2010, Governor Christie killed what would have been, not the first train tunnel, there are already two, but a third train tunnel that would have enabled almost a doubling of rail capacity between New Jersey and Manhattan, could have taken tens of thousands of cars off the road, would have increased real estate values in those New Jersey bedroom counties, and would have improved the quality of life for hundreds of thousands of people, the people who could have been taking those trains, and the drivers on the highways who wouldn't have quite as much traffic to battle with. And Christie did this so that he could raid or allocate the federal funds that were earmarked for that rail tunnel to continue to subsidize gasoline and not have to face the music of increasing New Jersey's gasoline tax, which is the second lowest of all the 50 states. So, Christie, in his faux populism of keeping a fossil fuel gasoline artificially cheap, worsens the quality of life and the economy for tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of his own constituents.
Now, this was $8 billion in federal funds, is that right?
It was largely federal funds. New York State and New Jersey would have had to kick in some, but it was mostly, if you will, found money, from the federal government that had gone through all kinds of vetting and was ready. This was a shovel-ready process. And my God, Harvey, you and I, and especially you, who have for decades trying to build a blue-green alliance between blue-collar workers, especially the construction trades, and green, environmentalists, this was a project that the blue and the green people often put at odds by the powers that be, were totally in concert with. And, the tragedy is that when Christie X'd this tunnel 4 years ago, is that the blue-collar workers and the green environmentalists did not march en masse on the governor's office in Trenton and try to force a reversal of that decision. We're just kind of dicking around, if I can say that, and not using the muscle that we really need to use to change policy.
Now, where would this tunnel have run in terms of the geography of Manhattan and New Jersey there? Where would the tunnel have started and ended?
Am I going to have to give a Governor Rick Perry type answer, not exactly knowing?
We don't have Rick Perry's hair, so Governor Good Hair, as Molly Ivins called him. That's not you. If you don't
sure
remember,
isn't.
It's okay. I don't remember. I don't know either. I'm just kind of curious.
But I think it probably would have been on, the main train lines, which are Amtrak, as well as New Jersey Transit, that go under the Hudson River into Penn Station. You know, so existing lines, existing stations, and simply adding capacity. So it's not so much that new communities would have been able to have the rail service as that the service would have been able to be much more frequent and therefore much more attractive to residents of New Jersey.
Right. Now, in Ohio, we had a very similar thing happen. The Republican governor who's going to be running for president, and I talked about him last week with Bob Fitrakis, John Kasich came in. And people, my friends and myself in Ohio, worked for decades to restore train traffic, train service between Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland. Columbus, Ohio, where I live, is the big, I believe, is the biggest capital in the Western world, with no passenger rail service.
Well,
and we got $400 million set aside of federal money. This is federal money to just, all they want to do is run a train. The right-of-way exists. So just put a train, just stick a little passenger car, self-propelled passenger car, on the existing freight lines between the three cities there in Ohio. And John Kasich came in, and the first thing he did when he got elected governor in Ohio was to kill a $400 million gift from the federal government. I mean, what is it with these guys? Why don't they, what is it with the Republicans and mass transit?
Well, you know, we know that they are in the thrall of some kind of bizarro, you know, ideology. But one of the political tragedy of this is that as the years and decades will go by, and drivers are going to be stuck, you know, in perpetual gridlock that could have been at least alleviated by these train lines that you're talking about, they will be shaking their fists at government, not at the Republican Party, not at the, you know, anti-science ideology that blocks so much progress, but at government. And so this, you know, Republican wrought failure of government is going to be enshrined as a discrediting of government in general.
Well, why I don't get it. What did Chris Christie and John Kasich have to gain by killing mass transit? Are they
totally
in the pocket
again, though,
of the auto lobby?
Christie had a very strong ulterior motive, which was he didn't have enough money in the New Jersey Transportation Trust Fund, which is financed through gasoline taxes. And he didn't have enough money because just as the repair needs of the state's highways are rising and rising as those highways age, the revenues taken in by the trust fund have been falling because, A, automobiles are getting somewhat more efficient, so they're, you know, the average mile is not requiring as much gasoline, and so, you know, the gas tax is not raising quite as much revenue. And more interestingly, the amount of miles driven in New Jersey, in the Northeast, and in almost all of the 50 states has plateaued, and in many states is actually going down into decline. And
we're
New Jersey,
that.
You know,
that's
something that we could talk about as why is that happening and what does that mean for sort of the future of cities and transportation, you know, et cetera. But in New Jersey, it meant that Christie had a budget emergency. And instead of presenting himself to the voters and saying, look, I may have run on a campaign of not increasing the gas tax, but reality is different than I expected, and we've got to, you know, do something to deal with this financing crisis. Instead, he grabbed this pot of money, which was for the so-called ARC tunnel, you know, the third rail tunnel from Jersey into Penn Station, Manhattan, and he has raided it to shore up the Transportation Trust Fund in his state.
Sickening, sickening. We're talking to Charles Komanoff, world's leading expert, one of the world's leading experts on energy, carbon, taxation. Charlie, how exactly would a carbon tax work? I mean, there's a lot of general discussion about carbon tax. Implement in our minds for us the carbon tax that you would like to see and how it would be done and who gets the revenue.
Sure. Well, there's two levels to talk about. One is kind of who would pay the tax, or, you know, where would the money be collected? And the other is how high should the tax be? So why don't we start with the first issue?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
So, you know, the carbon tax is not going to be sort of imposed in stores or even at the gas station, although, you know, it will kind of be felt there, but you won't be billed for it there. Rather, there are, it may seem surprising, only a couple of thousand, maybe 3,000 coal mines, natural gas gathering stations, oil gathering stations and oil import docks, you know, in the United States, places where fossil fuels are either taken from the ground and put into the commercial system, or the imports are landed, you know, from, say, the OPEC, you know, oil exporters and put into the system. And each of those places has very clear, you know, transactions and billing records. I guess it's called ladings. And at each of those places, at that transaction point where the oil is or coal or natural gas is purchased by the first purchaser after it's been taken out of the ground, that's where the tax would be paid.
Who would get the money?
Sorry?
Who gets the money? The Fed?
The federal government gets the money.
Okay. So you're talking about a federal carbon tax.
Yes. And even though, you know, there are initiatives at some of the state levels to have carbon taxes, kind of along the lines of what British Columbia, you know, the westernmost province in Canada, has been doing for since July 2008, so for half a dozen years, it really has to happen at the federal level.
Okay.
You know, it's fine to have a starter carbon tax in a couple of states as a way of establishing a template, if that's what this country of ours needs, you know, to have facts on the ground. But it's got to be at the federal level, because only at the federal level can the carbon tax be high enough. And the interstate, you know, kind of transactions begin to become very complex. So we are talking about a federal carbon tax. And once,
so do we tax oil and coal as they come out of the ground?
Exactly.
On the domestic side?
Yes, and we do the same thing as the imports are landed at U.S. ports.
Okay, all right.
And the tax is proportional, or would be proportional, to the carbon content of the fuel. And simply because of the chemistry of fossil fuels, the tax would be highest on coal, lowest, roughly half as much, on natural gas, and in between those two on petroleum products.
Now, is there a difference? How would you differentiate between carbon emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, and methane emissions?
There's got to be a methane tax as well as a carbon dioxide tax. And, you know, listeners, what Harvey is referring to is sort of two issues. One is that molecule for molecule, methane, which is the chemical compound that is natural gas, for decades is a more potent global warming, global weirding chemical than carbon dioxide, by quite a lot. So even if methane emissions are smaller, you know, relative to carbon dioxide emissions, they still figure importantly in the whole climate chaos, global weirding, you know, phenomenon. And, you know, the second issue is that the mining of natural gas, I'm saying mining because increasingly with fracking, which is how more and more natural gas is extracted from the ground, it's not gas extraction. It really is natural gas or methane mining. The fracking process, the pipeline gathering process, and the pipelines themselves are riven with leaks that are leaking this methane directly into the atmosphere where it's contributing to climate change. And because of totally inadequate regulation and because of an absence of a methane price, there is little, if any, incentive for those, you know, producers and transporters of methane or natural gas to rein in these so-called fugitive emissions. And so, yes, there's got to be a methane tax alongside of the carbon tax.
And what about, are people still flaring natural gas off the top of oil wells, or is that done?
Yeah, they are. I mean, ironically, flaring is less bad than just venting the gas. As grotesque as that is, I mean, it's sort of like saying, you know, beating your domestic partner, you know, is less bad than killing her, you know?
Yeah.
All through North Dakota, for example, the infrastructure is in place to put the oil in pipelines, but not to put the methane that is extracted from the ground alongside the oil. Huge amounts of methane, natural gas, are being flared, you know, in yet another crime against, you know, against nature and climate and against future generations.
God, it's so sick. It's just hard to comprehend. It's still on here.
Now, speaking of things that are hard to comprehend, we were emailing late last night, Harvey, you and I, about the auto racer Kyle Busch and his fantastic feat of using six different types of vehicles to race 1,000 miles at two different auto tracks yesterday. I mean, should we kind of riff on that for a few minutes?
Yeah, well, he flew his car from one place to another. I mean, it's insane what he did.
It's Kurt Busch. Sorry about that, Kyle.
Kurt W. Busch. Sorry, go ahead.
Kurt H.W. Busch.
Right.
Busch was one of, you know, dozens of racers at the annual Indianapolis 500-mile auto race in Indianapolis. I think he finished sixth, and he crossed the finish line at around 3 in the afternoon. He was bundled into a golf cart from the garage at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, then moved to a police cruiser, which transported him across the highway to the Indianapolis Speedway's helipad, transferred to the helicopter 9 minutes after having finished the auto race, which took him 6 miles to Indianapolis Airport, then flown in a private plane, of course, a Cessna Citation, 425 miles to Concord, North Carolina. And that trip took less than an hour. Then how did he get from the North Carolina airport to the Charlotte Motor Speedway for the second race? In a second helicopter, arriving a few minutes before 5 p.m. This is just an hour and a half after he's finished the race in Indianapolis, so that after a short nap, he could enter the field at the start of the Coca-Cola 600. So I guess this is, if you add 500 miles at Indy and 600 miles at Charlotte, that's 1,100 miles. Well, wow, what a great red-blooded American. How much carbon did he burn? And Harvey, you know what I should have done? I can't do it in real time. I should calculate how much a carbon tax, and you and I still have to talk about how high the carbon tax should be, how much Kyle Busch would have put into the federal treasury if his carbon use during those, you know, yesterday had been taxed in order to protect the climate.
Well, tell us then, how much would he have to pay? How would we calculate? How would we calculate this? How high should the carbon tax be?
Well, the gold standard, you know, carbon tax, the one that we like at the Carbon Tax Center, and that Jim Hansen, you know, the climatologist who has more than anybody else over the past quarter century been sounding the alarm on carbon and climate change, we want a carbon tax that starts at $15 per ton of carbon dioxide in the first year, and then every year thereafter goes up by $10 per ton of carbon dioxide every year, so that in the ninth year, it would be at a level of $100 per ton of carbon dioxide. Now, what does that translate to? You know, I mean, who would know, right? It's not as if we're familiar with the, you know, the metrics of carbon dioxide. It would be a $100 per ton carbon dioxide tax would be about 90 cents more on a gallon of gasoline. It would be depending on how much fossil fuel is in the electricity that you're buying from your utility, maybe another 10 cents a kilowatt hour on your electric bill, which is a lot. Although, you know, more importantly, before it got to that point, you probably would have switched to electricity from a wind farm.
Well, we would hope so. Charlie, how many, we're going to take a quick break here, but I want to ask you before we do, and then we'll come back to this very topic in 3 minutes. How much would that raise the burning? How much would you pay in your carbon tax level for burning a tank of gas in a car that gets, say, 15-gallon tank at 25 miles of the gallon? How much carbon is emitted, and what would the tax be on that?
You know what? Why don't we do that after the break?
That'd be great. All right, we're going to take a short break here. We're talking with Charles Koloff, his website, carbontax.org. We're talking about carbon taxes. We're going to segue in to Energiewende and what's happening in Germany, the lead article on his site. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes after Dana Lyons sings us the Solartopia Rocky Top version. All right, we are back. That's Dana Lyons, Cows with Guns, over 2 million hits on his YouTube, Cows with Guns, the anthem of the vegetarian movement, of which I am a proud member, except for that fish I eat from time to time. what can I tell you? Back with Charlie Komenoff. Charlie, you said something. Charles Komenoff at carbontax.org, world's leading experts on, one of the world's leading experts on carbon and energy. Charlie, you said before the break that the amount of driving that Americans is doing is dropping. Maybe I don't want to mischaracterize. So tell me, is it true that more gross miles or more per capita miles or are being driven in America?
It's per capita miles that have been dropping pretty clearly. I don't know the exact numbers, you know, but it's definitely a decline. And the total amount of driving, you know, which is different because the population is growing with, you know, more births and immigration, has leveled off. And I'm pretty sure, Harvey, and I apologize to the listeners that I don't have the numbers perfectly down, that 2007 was the highest amount of miles driven by all motor vehicles in the United States, and that, you know, even in 2013, with the limply rebounding economy, and again, a larger population, that the amount of driving has not rebounded to the 2007 peak.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, there's a parallel reality going on here, which is the prison population in the United States is actually dropping. Has dropped in the last 2 years in absolute numbers. You think there's a connection between the drop in driving and the drop in the prison population?
You know, I think I'd be hard-pressed to make that connection, but I'm glad that you're bringing it up. And, you know, I assume, and Harvey, I apologize if I haven't heard them, that you've done programs on the whole, you know, prison industrial complex and the disaster that it is, you know, in every way. And, you know, God bless the people who are working to turn that situation around.
Yeah, no, I haven't done a show, and I probably should. Maybe you can suggest an expert to me who really specializes in this. But, you know, of course, part of it is clearly having to do with the I don't know, weakening or reversing or diminishment of the drug war, and especially the legalization of pot. Which we is so long overdue. It's mind-boggling. In fact, the surest sign of the changing tide is I saw a big article. I can't remember if it was on Huffington or somewhere about the corporatization now of marijuana growing, talking about, you know, the big corporate farms that are now coming around for the growth of marijuana. I say, hey, what the hell, you know, we're going to grow it. At any rate, what do you think, why would the per capita driving in this country be diminishing? We certainly haven't had any great breakthroughs in mass transit.
Well, you know, a bunch of things. One is that more and more Americans are impoverished. And so, you know, simple pleasures, you know, such as they were to, you know, go for a drive or, you know, long vacations or just, you know, hop in the car and drive 50 miles, you know, to the new mall or 200 miles to the shore or the mountains. You know, a lot of people, a lot of families have to think twice before doing that. you know, with the meager rebound in jobs, there are, you know, maybe not fewer people driving to work. Although, actually, Harvey, I think it was only last year that the total amount of employed Americans limped back to the level that it was at the peak in 07, 08. More happily is that there seems to be a turning away from love of the automobile by younger people. You know, it's not quite like when we were teenagers and in our early 20s, Harvey. I mean, I was that way, and I imagine you were too, that, you know, getting a driver's license, getting your first car, rite of passage, girls, boys, sex, freedom. You know, and the whole kind of movie Hollywood ideology from the 50s into the 60s, and, you know, get on the open road. Well, not only is there not an open road anymore, but there is, you know, the iPhone and the internet and Facebook and messaging and, you know, which are ways that younger people like to kind of get together. And then in addition, or kind of at the same time, is the growing attachment to urban areas by young people. Because let's face it, cities are exciting. They're interesting. They're unpredictable. They're diverse. You know, they're new. They are where the action is, as opposed to, you know, the country, rural areas, and especially suburbs. So you've got millennials flocking to cities and sometimes, you know, tripling, quadrupling more, you know, to try to get some affordable place to live. But once they're in cities, they drive much less because cities just aren't geared up for driving. It's much more expensive to own and use a car in cities. And you can get around with transit and walking and on a bike because a lot of cities are constructing themselves differently and things are more proximate to you so that the things, the places where you want to go are within bus distance or bike distance.
Well, that's quite amazing. Of course, you deserve some of the credit, substantial credit for converting people, at least in New York City, to the bicycle. And I think bicycles are really having a significant impact. I mean, I can go for days and days in Columbus, Ohio, which is really nice and flat, you know, without getting in a car, largely because of my bicycle. And I think that that's actually is not a fringe issue anymore. It's a very real. Is there an absolute drop in gasoline consumption that you can talk about?
Oh, my goodness. Sure. And that ties into the Chris Christie discussion we were having before, you know, where he was looking at a gaping hole in his transportation trust fund, and he killed that mass transit rail tunnel in order to divert funds from that to be able to shore up his road repair revenue because he didn't have the political guts, you know, to raise his state gasoline tax. But U.S. petroleum consumption, you know, all forms, you know, diesel fuel, which is used by trucks and for heating, you know, propane, gasoline, you know, et cetera, is down. You know, I've got the numbers somewhere in front of my screen, but I'm not fast enough to get them. But it's probably down about 10% from the peak a half a dozen years ago. It's a big drop, Harvey.
Well, we're glad to hear that. And then we're also going to segue here now into a country where it's really dropping, which is Germany. Now, Germany is the world's fourth largest economy, the biggest in Europe. And they are undergoing this thing called Energiewende, Energiewende. And you have an article about that in actually, it was in the New York Times. Yes, or it's an attack on the New York Times. It's on your blog.
Yes, it is.
At carbontax.org.
Yeah,
and,
all the news.
Tell us about this.
Well, over several decades, but accelerating in the current decade, Germany, as you said, the fourth largest economy in the world, behind the U.S., China, and Japan, is consciously, you know, through public policy, transforming its energy economy from coal and nuclear into renewables. I mean, this is the solartopia that you have been advocating and, you know, framing and naming and writing about for so long. It is actually happening in Germany to the point that last year, 2013, more than a fifth of Germany's electricity was generated through renewable sources, wind, solar photovoltaics, and biofuels, not even counting hydroelectricity, you know, water over dams. And if we throw in the hydro, which is pretty modest in Germany, you know, it's a small country and they don't have wild rivers that they could dam for hydroelectricity, then the percentage or the share of renewables in Germany's electricity production inches up to be almost one quarter, almost 25%. And this is pretty amazing. For, you know, this major industrial society, which is having positive economic growth, robust employment growth, and it should be said, a much flatter distribution of income and wealth than in the United States. So on all cylinders, equity, economy, environment, ecology, sustainability, and I would even say affordability when you count things like health as, you know, part of the affordability equation. Germany is showing the rest of the world how to transition away from fossil and nuclear to renewable, efficient sustainability.
Well, Charles Komenoff, why do we keep seeing these articles, you know, every other day in various magazines about how the transition to renewables in Germany is causing the burning of more fossil fuels? Where is that coming from?
You know, as with a lot of myth, there's a little germ of truth that enables these, you know, reporters and editors to, you know, to put the huge negative spin blown completely out of proportion. And it may have been the case that from 2012 to 2013 in Germany, there was a tiny uptick, you know, 1 or 2% in the amount of coal, you know, burned in Germany to make electricity. And this, you know, minor factoid and transitory development is permitted to overshadow this profound makeover of the entire German economy away from fossil and nuclear to efficiency and renewables. And, you know, why it is that the New York Times would have article after article bemoaning the difficulty, the problems, you know, this Energiewende, that's how it's pronounced. In fact, Harvey, the only problem with the Energiewende is how to spell it and how to pronounce it for us non-German speakers.
Right.
But the New York Times has been problematizing this energy makeover in Germany, which it should also be said, and this is, you know, the other unspoken benefit, is that by aggressively purchasing and installing solar photovoltaics and wind turbines in Germany, German society is buying down the unit cost of solar and wind for the entire world. So solar, you know, why are solar panels now cheaper in the United States than they were several years ago? Well, you know, a bunch of reasons, but one of them is that Germany established as industrial policy that it would, yes, subsidize for a period of years, a transition period, the, you know, deployment of solar panels throughout Germany on homes, office buildings, you know, hospitals, factories, everywhere. You know, to the point where Germany, with 1/30th of the land area of the United States, is producing three times as many solar kilowatt hours as the United States. And in doing so, they are helping the entire world move up this price curve, or actually down the price curve, by buying down the price of solar and, to a lesser extent, wind. So why this is problematized instead of celebrated in the New York Times is beyond my understanding.
Well, you know, there's always some kind of vested interest. I just got the bad news I have to share. I had some solar guys, old friends of mine, out to talk about doing my house in central Ohio. And I can't really say this term, so I have to put it in quotes. We have too many trees. And so they did a Google map on my house, and they said, well, you have too many trees. You know, but at least I have south-facing windows. We put an addition on the house. We get a hell of a lot of sun and a lot of passive solar gain. And I'm buying up those LEDs. The LEDs are obviously also going to have a huge impact on fossil fuel consumption.
They sure do.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, there's another thing, too. You know, people are talking about building an energy grid in the so-called third world, although someone on this show called it the two-thirds world, you know, where there's not much electric power and people are impoverished without it. But those is Africa, primarily parts of Latin America, Southeast Asia, they're not going to get a grid. They're going to get solar panels, and that's going to drive the price down further. We're talking with Charles Komanoff of Energy Text at carbontext.org. And in your article here, you're talking about the plummeting of electric rates, partly due to a feed-in tariff. I've had Paul Geip on the show to talk about feed-in tariffs. Can you give another really quick explanation of feed-in tariffs and what impact they might have here in the United States if we went that route?
Well, you know, it's funny because the feed-in tariff by a different name was really initiated in California during the first two terms of the current governor, Jerry Brown, when he was governor from 1974 to 1982. All that it is a guaranteed price for solar production, you know, or wind power production or biomass electric production for some number of years at a high enough price to entice the manufacturers and the installers to actually, you know, put down money and put up the wind turbines, put up the solar panels, and get those kilowatt hours, you know, produced through solar and wind. And, you know, you can go that route or you can go a carbon tax route. Either one is going to speed up the transition away from fossil fuels to, you know, fossil-free efficiency and renewables. The reason that I support the carbon tax, and again, I think the feed-in tariff is great, and these can be complementary. The feed-in tariff only works with electricity. Now, that's a big deal, because electricity is about 40% of carbon dioxide emissions. It's the sector that's the most amenable to driving down those emissions quickly, which we need to do. But a carbon tax can work on transportation, on heating. It will incentivize, you know, for example, people to buy smaller homes, because, you know, knowing that it's going to cost more than they would have expected or more than it otherwise would to heat a home, once you've got the carbon tax, it's going to begin to push at the margin home builders to offer smaller homes and Americans to be satisfied with smaller homes. And as the standard, you know, the default begins to be 2,000 square foot homes instead of 4,000 square foot homes, you know, people will find themselves satisfied with that, you know, on and on and on. I don't want to make this into another plug for the carbon tax, but it's just a way of showing how the incentives with the carbon tax percolate through all of the economy.
But if the homes are solarized, then they can be larger, and
they can.
That's an incentive.
You know, it's not necessarily cheap to put on, you know, those solar panels for a 4,000 square foot home.
Right.
Aren't that many Americans, especially, you know, given the skewed income and wealth distribution now and the, you know, the sputtering economy, not that many Americans who are going to have those funds. And at some point, you know, the state subsidies or the federal subsidies are going to have to diminish, you know, so that those funds can go to other socially important purposes like schools and libraries and caring for veterans, you know, et cetera. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with downsizing back to the home sizes that we had in the 70s, you know, instead of everything having to get more and more supersized ad infinitum.
We're talking with Charles Komanoff. Carbontext.org is his website. Charlie, in your current blog, you cite five articles run by the New York Times putting down the energy wind transition in Germany to renewables. I want to point out, you said that at some point, I guess in 2013, renewables accounted for 20% of the electricity produced in Germany. That's actually higher than the percentage of electricity produced by nuclear power in the United States.
Good comparison.
That transition is happening. I also have posted an article at nukefree.org, the website is at nukefree.org, that cited a moment within the last couple of weeks in Germany, where 74% of the electricity was actually produced by renewables. And then, of course, we have to refer to that hilarious moment on Fox News where one of their genius commentators said that the reason Germany has more solar panels is because they have more sunlight than the United States. I don't know how he got that one out with a straight face.
Whoa, a country that is closer to the North Pole than the United States,
you
that has no deserts and more clouds. But that's Fox News.
We love Fox News. Of course, when you say Fox News, you have to say it with quotes around the news part. but at any rate, we're down to 5 minutes actually. How would you characterize the impact of the transition to green energy in Germany on the economy in Germany? What impact has it had?
Well, you know, again, if you just read those 5 most recent New York Times articles talking about Germany's energy makeover, you know, you would believe that, you know, Germans are, you know, freezing in the dark and barely able to open and read their unemployment benefits checks. But the facts are that Germany has more, you know, is closer to full employment than any major economy in the world. That its exports are thriving, German society is humming along very well. I think we alluded to this earlier. You know, pretty much on all cylinders. Whether this is despite the Energiewende or because of the Energiewende or independent of the Energiewende, you know, I don't know. But cast the current situation in Germany as a country that is hobbled and suffering because of the transition away from fossil and nuclear to efficiency and renewables is just completely bizarre.
It is bizarre, and it's good to know this is happening so quickly. Hopefully, I'm not sure the Japanese are going to have any other choice but to go the same direction. I'm about to post a piece. There were 54 reactors licensed to operate in Japan when Fukushima was hit on 3/11/11. And briefly, a couple of them did reopen, but all reactors in Japan are now shut. This was about 30% of their electric supply.
Yeah.
And they are, of course, importing large quantities of fossil fuel or fossil fuel-produced electricity. But I don't know what choice Japan is going to have except to go the renewable route that Germany is pioneering.
Well, you know, we'd like to think so. It's a bit of a mystery to me as to why Japan, you know, right after Fukushima 3 years ago, didn't embrace, you know, the German path of efficiency and renewables, and, you know, not just to be able to keep the lights going, but as a way to, you know, kind of restructure and, you know, create a new vision for Japanese society.
We have talked this hour. I missed the cue to go out. Charlie Komen, a great energy expert, once again on hours flown by, carbontax.org. Thanks so much for being with us, Charlie.
It's always
and
a pleasure.
We'll be back to you another time. This has been the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Charlie has been in New York City. I'm in D.C. Thank you to the crew in New York. We'll be back again next week in Solartopia with another hour of green power and wellness.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia.